edition of the Dog and Duck Show. What seemed to be like a potential slow wait week on the calendar just a few days ago has become sports central, as all kinds of stories have been brought up over the last few days. We've got a lot to talk about, from the massive Seattle Seahawks trade of Russell Wilson and the release of Bobby Wagner, March Madness, Dog and Duck news, and so much more. Mark, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, Warren. I love conference championship week, and when conference championship week comes with the Seahawks losing their franchise quarterback and all of my Seahawks friends losing their mind, it just doubles the fun. You know, a lot to talk about this week.
Well, absolutely. And as we like to do around here, we always start with some Dog and Duck news. We are the Dog and Duck Show, of course. And as the dog, let me just get right into it and ask the question, Mark. As we recorded our podcast last week, I spoke with much fear, internal defeat, and trepidation about the outcome of the Husky Duck basketball game that was about to take place just as we were recording the podcast. Well, things definitely worked out in the Husky favor, and the Huskies came away with a dominating win after getting destroyed by this Duck team not too long before that. What does that mean for this Duck team, and what did you take away from the Huskies' win over the Ducks?
Well, I think at that time, Oregon was in decent shape if they could take care of business against the Washington schools and then win a couple games in the Pac-12 tournament, that they would have probably made the NCAA tournament. What instead happened, they get trounced by the Huskies. They got trounced even worse by the Cougars. They come into the Pac-12 tournament where they beat Oregon State, who was 3-28 on the year. So I give them no credit for beating the Beavers. And then today, they lose to Colorado. Will Richardson, their leading scorer, missed the Pac-12 tournament due to illness. So it was kind of known going into the tournament that this they just didn't have it this year. So their regular season is done. Their NCAA tournament hopes are done. I would expect they'll find themselves in the NIT. And right now, the only real thing I care about at this point, Warren, is Dana Altman is in his 12th year at the University of Oregon. In that span of time, he has won 20 games every year to this point, and he's currently sitting at 19 wins on the season. So all I care about is Oregon getting into the NIT and getting a 20th win just to keep that streak alive. But for all intents and purposes, the Oregon men's basketball season is over.
So as the season, you know, concludes, the Oregon Ducks finish in the conference at 11-9 with the same record as the Washington Huskies.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody really saw that coming 3 weeks ago, or, you know, certainly not at the beginning of the season, where I think the Huskies were picked 11th for the conference. The Huskies are, they won their opening playoff game against Utah last night. They prepare to play USC this evening. It would take, I think, a pretty dramatic performance for them to be able to get past USC. But I think that Mike Hopkins has done enough in this season to stick around for another year. But I think for most Husky fans, the question is, what do we take away from this season? Because you've got this team that has performed above expectations with a transfer portal roster, and its best offensive player will be gone at the end of this season. And so it's kind of start over, back to the drawing board. But this seems like that's pretty familiar territory for Oregon Duck fans. What should Husky fans be thinking about as it relates to this new mindset of the annual reset of your basketball team?
It's a great question because this year I felt better about the transfer roster, the roster full of transfers that Dana Altman had assembled. I felt better about it this year than I had in the last few years. Mm. And then they totally underachieved right from the beginning of the season on. Whereas in the past, there have been some times where it's like, who is even on this team? We've got these random guys from these random schools. And then they've kind of melded into some cohesive unit. So I have no idea what to expect from Oregon next year. And I wouldn't have much idea of what to expect of Washington next year. I think, you know, I have some comfort level in that Dana Altman has a pretty good track record with this, but I think this is something that every coach is kind of getting a learning curve in. Mike Hopkins is going to be, I'm sure, incorporating more and more transfers as the years go on. So I think you have to just be encouraged that this was a better looking team than last year. They looked a little more competitive, at least against the mid-tier schools. And that's something that at least gives you a little more hope that Hopkins can keep things going in the right direction.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's still questions about what kind of an offense are we really running? I mean, this year it was Terrell Brown and let him try to keep the team in the game. And boy, he did. Terrell Brown, by the way, is closing in on some big time UW scoring records. I don't think he's going to, come into the top two, but if they could somehow get this win against USC and Terrell Brown could put together two or three more 20, 22 point games, he'll finish as a top three or four single season scorer in Husky basketball, which is pretty remarkable. He's coming up on Andrew Andrews. And then the only guys ahead of him are Christian Welp and some guy from the 50s. So pretty remarkable territory for a guy that, wasn't highly recruited coming out of high school and has really, done a tremendous job for this Husky team. Well, hey, what is there anything else going on with the Ducks that we need to mention before we get into the Seahawks?
Well, no, let's get into the Seahawks, but I just want to make one more point, and this is to get something off my chest about this Oregon and Washington finishing tied in the standings.
Right.
There are like a legit three NCAA tournament teams in the Pac-12. Colorado may be a fourth, but for sure, Arizona, UCLA, and USC were the best three teams in the league this year. Okay. Right. Oregon played those teams collectively five times. They won three of those games. They lost one of them on the road by 3 points. They lost one of them at home by 1 point. So if you just took that five game sample size, you would have said Oregon is absolutely every bit as good as the top three teams in the conference. If you looked at Washington lost all five games to that group of teams. They lost all of them by double digits. They lost three of them by more than 20 points. There is nothing in Washington's track record against Arizona, UCLA, and USC. Now watch them go beat USC tonight. But to this point, there had been nothing in Washington's track record to say, they're on the level with those teams. And yet Oregon and Washington finished tied in the standings. And the reason for that is simply that Oregon did not play that well when they were playing mid-tier and lower-tier Pac-12 teams, completely squandering games, not showing up with the energy and the effort that was needed. And Washington, for the most part, equipped themselves really well in those games. Like when you go 0-5 against the best teams in the league and you finish with a winning record in conference, it means you really took care of business against the rest of your schedule. So I think this is the rare season where I would say, Mike Hopkins, for instance, I think totally outcoached Dana Altman. If you look at the results on the floor week to week and game to game.
Well, I mean, it seems like to me that what you're saying is that the ceiling for the Ducks was much higher, but the floor was much lower for this Ducks team.
And I think the effort was much more inconsistent. I mean, Dana Altman said as much throughout the season, basically, that the team just did not play as hard night to night as they needed to in order to compete for a tournament berth.
Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, it's interesting because, like you said, same record in conference, 11-9. Most Husky fans, I would say, are probably pleasantly surprised, especially it's always nice to win your last conference, regular season game against the Ducks. Most Duck fans, I'm sure, are, you know, very much disgruntled with the way that this thing turned out.
100%. Yeah.
All right, let's get into it. This is the big news. The world stopped, the sky broke open, and the news came out that after over 12 months of speculation, rumors, and all kinds of conversation on the national level, Russell Wilson was indeed traded. He is no longer a Seattle Seahawk. He has been traded to the Denver Broncos. As everybody knows, the Seahawks give up Russell Wilson and a fourth round pick, and in return get the incumbent quarterback for the Denver Broncos, Drew Lock, tight end Noah Fant, defensive lineman Shelby Davis, two first round picks, one this year, one next year, two second round picks, one this year and one next year, and a fifth round pick in return. Mark, what was your immediate reaction when you heard that news?
Well, first of all, I heard that news in a text message from you. So yeah, you were the newsbreaker. And my initial reaction was, this is totally unprecedented. It is totally unprecedented for a quarterback to have, for a team to have a quarterback of Russell Wilson's ability and track record, and to trade him while he's still relatively in the prime of his career, to trade him without having somebody else on the roster that you think is very clearly the incumbent. You know, I think the only quarterback I can think of this caliber that was traded would have been when Joe Montana was traded to the Chiefs. And that was coming off of a season in which he missed an entire season due to injury. He was at the later end of his career, and they had Steve Young on the roster that they'd already seen enough of in games to go, this guy is the next thing, we can move on. But like, teams don't do this, Warren. Teams do not trade blue chip quarterbacks for any reason. Like, you hang on to those guys as long as you possibly can. And so for the Seahawks to do this, it's thoroughly unprecedented. I think it's likely to turn out disastrous, but I guess there's also an angle where it doesn't turn out disastrous. But that was my take as an impassioned, or as a not impassioned observer. You are actually a Seahawks fan. What did you think of all this?
You know, I mean, I like a lot of people in the city of Seattle thought, okay, these are just rumors and they're ridiculous. You know, there's no way, like you said, this is unprecedented. There's no way that the hardest thing to do in the NFL is to find a franchise quarterback.
Yeah.
And perhaps the hardest position in all of sports is to be a franchise Super Bowl winning quarterback. And like you said, you know, Russell Wilson is smack dab in the middle of his prime, because in this new era of professional football, it is expected that these guys will play until they are in their late 30s, or even, as Tom Brady has demonstrated, into your 40s. And Russell Wilson has made no bones that is his goal. He wants to be Tom Brady. He wants to play till he's 44, 45 years old and win five more Super Bowls. I mean, that's his mentality. So to give up the hardest position to acquire in the middle of his prime, with, you know, with that being, you know, just, and, you know, and then when you throw in what he's accomplished, what he's meant to this team, what he's meant to this city, from a sports perspective, but also from a community service perspective, bringing the Seahawks their first Super Bowl championship. This is just, it's just unbelievable. And that's all of the emotion that I think most Seahawk fans are experiencing, at least ones who were part of that ride, you know, from 2012 to, you know, winning the Super Bowl. But yet I think at the same time, if you look at it from an analytical perspective, you have to kind of take stock of the fact that, number one, there has been quite a bit of, you know, conversation over the last year or two about how badly does Russell really want to be in Seattle. Yeah. And does he see eye to eye with Pete Carroll about how this offense is going to be run? He's already making $35 million a year, and he's due to have his contract renewed or re-arbitrated next year. And with the news yesterday morning that that Aaron Rodgers had, you know, had presumably signed a contract for 4 years and $200 million, you have to assume that that's the number that Russell Wilson is going to be starting out with next year when he goes into contract negotiations. And I just don't know if you can win a Super Bowl in this era with a quarterback that's making that big of a percentage of your entire, you know, your entire salary cap. So yeah, this is going to come down to what can Pete Carroll and John Schneider do with those two first round picks and those two second round picks this draft and next year's draft. And then can they find a quarterback that can somehow recreate what Russell Wilson was able to do in the first 3 or 4 years of his career?
Yeah, I think, you know, you talked about the draft picks, and when we were texting this week, you know, I referenced the Herschel Walker trade, the Dallas Cowboys trading their best player to the Minnesota Vikings for a heap of draft picks. And I think in that deal, they got three first round picks, three second round picks, and a third round pick. I mean, so they got more picks and they got a few players thrown in. I mean, that was a truckload of players. But if you look at what that draft haul did, is the Cowboys drafting over about a 7 year stretch was ridiculous. You know, they drafted Michael Irvin in the first round 1 year, Troy Aikman the next year, Emmett Smith the next year, and drafted a heap of other, you know, really great players for them, Ken Norton Jr. and Darren Woodson and these different, you know, Pro Bowl caliber players. And they formed the basis of a three-time Super Bowl champion over a period of drafts. And if I'm a Seahawks fan, I'm thinking we know what that's like a little bit, because the Seahawks had a run that included drafting Russell Wilson, where they drafted several great players, Bobby Wagner, Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, Cam Chancellor, you know, one right after the other. They had about a five-year stretch there where every year they nailed their draft picks, and it formed, you know, the foundation of that Super Bowl team. So they have a track record of this. They've done it before, but it's putting a lot of pressure on them to do that again. Like it would kind of be like, it's like looking at the Golden State Warriors who drafted Steph Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson. And
saying, do that again.
And saying, just do that again. Do that again.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's exactly right. And I think there's a unique distinction, I think, about what you just shared. So you talked about Jerry Jones, Jimmy Johnson, and that massive haul. And, you know, you talk about hitting the Powerball jackpot with a trade. That was it. I mean, they got way more value, way more picks than they ever should have gotten for Herschel Walker. And then they just hit a home run on almost every single one of those picks. So, you know, they that was like the ultimate parlay you know, experience. But why did that happen? And how did that happen? And I think what there's a key aspect to that that has similarities to what you talked about with Pete Carroll. And that is that both Jimmy Johnson and Pete Carroll had just left premier college football programs where they had an incredible understanding of the players that were coming out of the draft in those subsequent years. Jimmy Johnson, when he was at Miami, that was the ultimate hub of talent in college football at that time. So obviously he knew Michael Irvin and he knew what he could do, but he also had studied and recruited and scouted against some of the best players in college football. He knew coaches, he had relationships, he had ways to get inside information on some of those players. Same thing with Pete Carroll. You know, one of the great stories about that, the early days of Pete Carroll, is the fact that Pete Carroll drafted Earl Thomas in the first round instead of his safety, Taylor Mays, for the USC Trojans. And there was a lot of consternation about why would he take Earl Thomas instead of his own guy? Right. Well, he knew something. And, you know, nobody ever saw or heard of Taylor Mays again after college, but Earl Thomas became a Hall of Fame safety for that Legion of Boom. And I think that's what's missing in this iteration of this thing, is that, you know, now Pete Carroll is, you know, 10 years removed from the college football scene. And the last 5 to 7 years, the drafting for the Seahawks has not been elite. It's not been as terrible as some people think. We've hit on some guys, but it hasn't been that elite drafting like it was. I mean, even think about some of the guys that they got from free agency, undrafted free agents, guys like Doug Baldwin and Jermaine Kearse. Those are guys that Pete Carroll had seen in you know, his time as a coach at USC, and he knew that those guys could ball out. So, you know, I think that's the challenge that the Seahawks are going to face now, is how are they going to get those home run picks in those first few rounds with these extra picks, but then even more importantly, those third, fourth, fifth round picks we've been missing on over the last several years.
So what I'm really hearing you say is that this is the time that the Seahawks should be trying to hire Ryan Day or Dabo Swinney or one of these, you know, high profile, Lincoln Riley. Like, this is the time you go in and you hire one of those blue chip college coaches and let him run your draft.
No, you know, I mean, that's not as crazy as it sounds. Yeah. I mean, I think John Schneider is married to Pete Carroll right now. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to let Pete Carroll out of here. You know, very similar to Russell Wilson. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame coach. He's got a few more years left, but you're absolutely right. You've got this draft pick, stockpile now. If they could bring in a guy like Dabo Swinney, which I'm sure there's a lot of college football fans who would love to see Dabo go to the NFL. But yeah, I think a guy like Dabo could really seize on an opportunity like that. And who knows, maybe John Schneider is giving Dabo a call, because I know Dabo is not happy with the state of college football right now. But to your point, I mean, I think the outcome of this trade, I think, is ultimately going to come down to whether or not the Seahawks can find a quarterback. Whether that's with one of those picks, whether that's a reclamation project or a free agency, you know, haul, they've got to get a quarterback. And then what can they do with these picks?
It'll be fascinating to see it unfold. I'm curious what do you think this means for Denver? Like, is Denver now a shortlist Super Bowl contender, or is that speaking too highly of Russell to think that automatically he's just going to make that team? I mean, we've now seen 2 years in a row where the Super Bowl champ basically rented a quarterback from another team. You know, the Bucks go and get Tom Brady. They add him to a roster that had some other pieces in place, and they become a Super Bowl team. And then the Rams add Matt Stafford and do the same thing. So, I mean, is it fair to say that that's what Denver is trying to do here? That Denver is basically trying to keep that streak going of teams that just grab a quarterback from another team and add them to a roster and all of a sudden have a Super Bowl winner?
Well, I don't think it's going to be that easy for the Denver Broncos, but I think that adding Russell Wilson gives them a fighting chance now. You know, they're in a conference that's got Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, Joe Burrow, Justin Herbert. You know, it's got Bill Belichick and his, you know, protege, Mac Jones. So you've got a conference with some of the best up-and-coming quarterbacks in the NFL that are going to be there for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think the Broncos management just realized there's nothing that we can do. We literally have no chance if we can't get ourselves a franchise level quarterback. So they're going to still have to figure out how to out scheme Andy Reid.
Yeah.
They're gonna have to still figure out how to, you know, thwart Bill Belichick. Those problems are not going away, but at least Russell Wilson gives them a fighting chance. It gives them an opportunity to throw some haymakers and, you know, potentially knock out one of these heavyweights now with a high, but there's no way you can say that the Denver Broncos are now a Super Bowl favorite to win because of Russell Wilson. That would be foolishness.
How do you think Seahawk fans now, like we're going to get into like Russell Wilson's legacy, where does he rank among the great Seahawks and among the great sports figures, but I'm just thinking, like, how do Seahawks fans view, I mean, this was driven clearly by Russell Wilson wanted out of Seattle. Yeah. And I'm thinking about, like, for Seattle, there's this history of, like, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. asking for a trade, a beloved Mariner. But in that case, he was asking for a trade to Cincinnati, where he grew up, where his father played. And it was very clear that he just kind of had this desire to play in his hometown. And it felt like Mariner fans were super bummed to see that happen, but also kind of that he left with their blessing and that they've welcomed him back since then, that there wasn't really many hard feelings, because there was a sense of, like, everybody should be allowed to go home if they, you know, have that urge at some point. But, like, Russell Wilson went to Denver. Like, he doesn't, yeah, you know. And that wasn't even on, like, the short list of the cities that I think he wanted to go to. Didn't he, like, leak a list and it was, like, yeah, LA and New York and Las Vegas, you know, kind of these entertainment hubs for his wife to do her thing. And, but it's like Russell Wilson asked out, he's now in Denver. It's hard to think that, like, he's that much more set up for success long-term in Denver than he is in Seattle. I would argue that maybe he's less set up for success. So how do Seahawk fans interpret all this, that one of the foundational players of this franchise just said, I don't want to be here anymore?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, let me say, you know, I have always been a Russell Wilson fan. I do admire him as a person. And I think that a lot of the negative commentary that people have towards him is unfair and unfounded. But that being said, I think that the narrative with Russell Wilson is and will continue to be really, you know, I'm kind of making this up on the spot, but you know, the Russell Wilson era with the Seahawks is kind of divided by BC and AI. And, you know, BC is before Ciara and AI is after the interception in the Super Bowl.
Okay.
So before Ciara, the narrative about Russell Wilson was, here you have this undersized, you know, overachieving guy that works harder than anybody else. You know, he gets drafted in the third round and he learns the playbook, you know, in 72 hours and just, you know, blows Pete Carroll's socks off.
Yeah.
Does whatever is needed to be done, never misses a game, and is always clutch in the final minutes when the Seahawks need him. And I think that was kind of the Russell Wilson legacy for the first few years of his career. And then I think with Ciara, him marrying Ciara, and then the interception in the Super Bowl. And I think what that did for a lot of fans and even internally within the team was there was this narrative that it was becoming more about Russell being the center and trying to make him the superstar and the rock star and the pop cultural icon that I think really rubbed a lot of players the wrong way and have ultimately rubbed a lot of fans the wrong way. And, you know, and Russell's a guy with kind of, it's almost like he's kind of got two personas. You know, he's this guy that goes to the children's hospital and visits the kids and, you know, daily tweets out Bible verses and you know, things related to his faith in Jesus. And then at the same time, we see these pictures of him with his wife and they're all kind of dressed up in Hollywood and acting cool and sexy and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and I think people just kind of start to feel like, what is your story? What is your deal? You know, and is football as important to you now as it was in those early years when we were going to the Super Bowl? And so I think that what that means for a lot of the legacy of Russell Wilson is that a lot of people are conflicted. They're kind of like, I loved him. He was a great player, but maybe it's time for us to move on. And what's unfortunate about that is that I think there's a very strong likelihood that we could go years, if not a decade or more, before we have another quarterback that's comparable to him, and we'll be lamenting the loss of Russell Wilson for a long time.
Is he, that's all well said. Can we get into this? Is he the greatest Seahawk of all time? Is that putting it too strongly?
I don't think so. I mean, I who's on that short list? I think to me, as somebody that grew up here in Seattle, you know, my all-time great had to be Steve Largent. And then, you had kind of maybe, you know, Matt Hasselbeck, Cortez Kennedy, Russell Okung, no, not Russell Okung.
Walter Jones,
and then Bobby Wagner. You know, I think those are kind of the guys that you would kind of put into that category.
Obviously, none of the secondary members from the Legion of Boom, they weren't there long enough. Is that?
I was going to say the Legion of Boom. I think that they were so great together as a unit, yeah. But I don't know if I could really separate and say Richard Sherman was better than Earl Thomas or Cam Chancellor. They were kind of this unit that is historically amazing and will never be forgotten. I personally would say, yes, I think Russell Wilson goes down as the greatest Seahawk Because as the quarterback that led this team to two Super Bowls, winning one, that to me is the hardest thing to do in all of sports. Steve Largent, I feel like because he was there for his whole career, and when Largent retired, he pretty much owned every receiving record in the NFL, obviously to be eclipsed by many players, but preeminently by Jerry Rice. But when he retired, we could say that he was, you know, the most accomplished, if not the best, the most accomplished wide receiver in NFL history. So there's an argument I think you can make for Steve Largent, but he never really got them very far in the playoffs, and certainly not to the Super Bowl or winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah, I think relative to their positions, like I think Walter Jones was a better tackle than Russell Wilson was a quarterback.
Sure.
You know, like, and I think that Cortez Kennedy was a better defensive lineman than Russell. Like, Cortez Kennedy in his prime was the best defensive lineman in the league. Right. Russell Wilson was never the best quarterback in the league, but I think because he played quarterback and because he was on a Super Bowl winning team, and was just such a media presence, you know, I think he will go down as kind of the greatest Seahawk. Even if there maybe are other players that, like, well, if you really do some digging, maybe they were actually better at what they did than Russell at what he did. But I think Russell's the quarterback, and that's kind of how these kind of legacies get formed. But I don't know, like, if you were to give a statue to one Seahawk, it's not going to be Russell Wilson, right? Like, I mean, you can't give it to the guy that asked for the trade. You'd have to give it to Steve Largent or Cortez Kennedy or somebody like that, right?
No, I mean, I think if you're going to build a statue with Steve Largent, the guy retired with every record and all that. But to go back to, you know, what you're saying about Russell Wilson, I think that's where it's really difficult as fans, because he never was the best quarterback in the NFL in a single season. Like, you know, it's often brought up, he never won an MVP. But when you hear about what he did over the first 10 years of his career, he's always in the same category as Peyton Manning, Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, in terms of, you know, most wins, most touchdown throws, you know, highest percentage of, you know, QBR, all those things. And so to kind of say, well, he's never really been an elite quarterback, it really depends on what numbers you want to look at, because he was consistently, you know, over time, one of the best quarterbacks to ever play in the first 10 years of his career. What happens from here on out still is yet to be written, but you know, in my mind, he's easily a Hall of Fame quarterback, even if he never wins an MVP, you know, for a single season.
Yeah, I think it's splitting hairs. I think he's definitely a Hall of Famer. He's definitely, like, included in that group. And I don't know how big the group is. It's maybe about 10 guys in the modern era. But the lack of an MVP, you know, that's where you start to split hairs and are like, well, you know, so maybe Russell Wilson's like 10th on that list instead of, you know, higher up. Like, I think
honestly, that's part of the reason why Russell wanted to leave, was because, you know, he's like, I can't do what I need to do from an offensive standpoint, where, you know, how many times as Seahawk fans did we watch the offense just do nothing for 2/3 of the game? And then midway through the third quarter, it's like, okay, we're going to start playing offense now. and yeah. Russell becomes magic. He brings the team back. And, you know, at the end of the day, he's got pretty good numbers. You know, he's thrown for 270 yards, three touchdowns, no interceptions, ran for 60 yards at the end of the game, you know, and you're like, that was a really good game. But what would have happened if they had let him loose, you know, for the whole game? And that was never Pete Carroll's philosophy. And maybe that helped them win a lot of games. That's debatable. I think that's part of the challenge with this thing. But, you know, when you think about 2020, the year that the expression "let Russ cook" kind of picked up steam, the first half of 2020, Russell Wilson was on pace to throw for something like 5,500 yards right. and 56 touchdowns. But they were losing.
Right.
And, you know, and then, you know, arguably what, you know, some people surmise was that Pete Carroll said, I'm done with this, shut it down. And for the remainder of the season, Russell was kind of handcuffed and, you know, the numbers kind of dropped dramatically. And I think that was probably for Russell, that point of him saying, I'll never have the opportunity to put up the kind of numbers that I need to win that MVP, to get, to gain the credibility of an all-time great quarterback in this system with this coach.
It's an interesting perspective. And it'll be interesting to see if he finds that in Denver. You know, I have my doubts that, that the offensive skill players are, I mean, I look at it, in Seattle, he had DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. Like, what are the odds that he's going to have a better pair of receivers in the next few years in Denver? I wouldn't think they're very high.
Well, I mean, you know, the Broncos do have a couple of good running backs, and they've got Jerry Jeudy and Courtland Sutton, who are, I think, upper, you know, they're above average wide receivers. And honestly, it's kind of one of those deals where we don't know how good those guys can be with a decent quarterback. They may end up being better, but I think the real question is, you know, what does Nathaniel Hackett, the new head coach, you know, bring to the table as a guy coming from, you know, the Green Bay Packers, you know, Aaron Rodgers system, and will Russell Wilson be the piece that allows him to really run the offense that he wants to run?
Yeah. Time will tell, I guess. Time will tell.
Yeah. So, you know, when you think about what's happening with the Seahawks team, you know, you've got Russell Wilson is gone. You've got Bobby Wagner is gone, which gives them, you know, 50 something million dollars in cap space, this draft collateral that they can use. What's the philosophy, do you think? Is it rebuild? Is it, you know, try to find a stopgap quarterback and then, you know, draft somebody and develop them? Do they go after a Deshaun Watson if he gets cleared of his charges? You know, what, yeah. With Pete Carroll's age, it kind of makes you wonder, like, what's the strategy here?
Yeah, I can't think at Pete Carroll's age he's signing up for, like, a tank job. I don't think he's going to just be like, well, let's throw the next two seasons away and build up the draft capital and then try to rebuild this thing. I think he's going to want to stitch something together and then try to make a few shrewd moves to, you know, better the team along the way. I don't know that Deshaun Watson is really going to be a realistic choice for anyone soon. I don't know who you get as that kind of stopgap solution. Is it, you know, I think you mentioned what, Tyrod Taylor or Marcus Mariota or Colin Kaepernick, like, you know, Tim Tebow. No. I mean, I think they'll be looking under every rock to try to find out, okay, who's that guy that could come in and at least kind of keep us above water. I don't think they want to do a full rebuild. And I also think you mentioned the weight of the quarterbacks in the AFC. The NFC feels a little more wide open. You know, if Tom Brady stays retired and doesn't come back to the Niners, as has been rumored. You know, you had Drew Brees recently retire. There's kind of been a changing of the guard. Now you've got Russell Wilson leaving the conference. So, you know, you're looking at like, well, who are the contenders? Well, the Packers are always relevant with Rodgers. Right. And the Rams figure to be relevant, but they also kind of really invested a lot in this Super Bowl season and are probably going to get into some trouble with salary cap issues and everything, you know, as those contracts play out. But then you're talking about, like, you're talking yourself into Kyler Murray and the Cardinals. You're talking yourself into Dak Prescott and the Cowboys. And you know, those are teams that you don't necessarily feel like are imposing powers that are going to dominate the conference. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm running the Seahawks, I'm thinking, you know, why can't we like build a contender on the fly? Why can't we make a couple moves and, you know, try to win 10 games next year and sneak into the playoffs and see what happens? Like I think the NFC is wide open enough that you could try doing that there. Whereas, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles made the playoffs last year with Jalen Hurts as a quarterback. Like Jalen Hurts is, you know, he's a decent quarterback. Like, but that, if that's the caliber of quarterback it takes to make the playoffs in the NFC, then the Seahawks might be able to find someone like that.
Well, they're the NFC East, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the NFC East.
Because the Cowboys won the NFC East.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but the NFC East the last few years has been one of the worst, you know, divisions in football with, you know, with the Redskins floundering and the Giants floundering. And I mean, look at the Giants. I mean, they're a great example of a team that they have not been able to find a quarterback. And Daniel Jones has not been able to put it together. The Washington Commanders have not been able to put it together with a quarterback. And I think that's the fear, is like, you know, if you don't have that quarterback, you're fighting with one hand tied behind your back, you know. But I think it's an interesting thing, because I think this is going to be the opportunity for Pete Carroll to really prove or be proven wrong in his philosophy, because I think he wants to get back to defense. I would anticipate that you're going to see with these draft picks a lot of emphasis put on shoring up some of the holes that have been created on the defensive side of the ball, because of the money that has been spent on offense over the last few years. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the Seahawks not draft an offensive player with the first and second round draft picks, but taking defensive guys, trying to, you know, find that edge rusher, trying to find that premier cornerback, trying to find those defensive tackles that can wreck the game. But I think, you know, going back to that conversation of, do we need that elite quarterback with the NFC in its current position? It's so interesting how things change so quickly, because, you know, I think at the beginning of last year, I thought, wow, the NFC West is the strongest division in all of football. You've got Matthew Stafford. You've got Kyler Murray, who seems like an up-and-coming superstar. Russell Wilson, who's in the prime of his career. Jimmy G, who's not that bad. He's won, you know, he's made it to the Super Bowl, and a backup in Trey Lance, who seems to be, you know, overflowing with talent. And now you look at it and you go, okay, maybe Kyler Murray's not as good as we thought he was. And, you know, how long can Stafford do this with the money that they've spent, you know, and will the talent dissipate around him? So yeah, it's an interesting dynamic how that just changes overnight.
Yeah, for sure. Can we say a few words about the great Bobby Wagner? I feel like it would be, you know, disrespectful to him. I mean, all of the news was focused on the Russell Wilson trade, but here you have, you know, one of the greatest defensive players in team history getting released on the same day, came in with in the same draft as Russell Wilson, also a future Hall of Famer. I mean, this is really, really the end of an era for the Seahawks to have Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner both leaving on the same day.
Well, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, he was named to the 2022 Pro Bowl roster. So this is not a guy that it was just obvious that his career was over. You know, he wasn't limping off of the field and, you know, waving goodbye at the end of the season. This is a guy that was still performing at a high level. And I think what shocked me about this move was the fact that we couldn't get anything for him. You know, the fact that we literally just straight up released him is really shocking. Yeah. I really thought that there was a good likelihood that we would get rid of Bobby Wagner over this offseason, but I thought we would get at least a third round draft pick for him to a team that felt like they were, you know, one linebacker away from having, you know, a Super Bowl quality defense. So that really surprises me. And it's unfortunate because I think, you know, you mentioned Walter Jones, and I would say, you know, an equal level to Walter Jones in terms of being the most dominant player at his position for multiple years, that's Bobby Wagner.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we have ever truly appreciated Bobby Wagner like he deserves, because he's a humble guy. He doesn't, you know, he's not the Richard Sherman, you know, kind of self-promoter. You know, he didn't have those, you know, he wasn't that massive hitter like Cam Chancellor. He wasn't that, you know, kind of eccentric speed demon like Earl Thomas. He was just the glue. He was the ultimate glue guy that ran that defense and did it as a true professional, and never really drew attention to himself. And it's unfortunate that guys like that don't get more celebration and praise.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best pure tacklers in the NFL, like just a guy that just made a ton of tackles. And like you said, still is an elite linebacker. Here's a stat for you, Warren, about Bobby Wagner. You look at guys that are voted first team all pro, which is really, you know, the signature of like, was this the best guy at his position? So if we're looking at linebackers over the last 40 years, how many times were they voted first team all pro? Mm-hmm. Lawrence Taylor, 8 times. Ray Lewis and Mike Singletary, 7 times. And then you have Bobby Wagner and Junior Seau, 6 times voted first team all pro. And he's potentially not done yet, you know, could add to that with second team all pro this past season. So, but that's like, those are 4 of the all time greats that I just named as a linebacker. And Bobby Wagner is right there with him in terms of how he was viewed by his peers, how he was viewed by those covering the league, you know, relative to the players that he was playing against. I mean, he put together a really great 10-year run for the Seahawks, and I think arguably could be missed as much as Russell Wilson.
Well, there's no doubt that there's no way we're just going to replace Bobby Wagner and what he did over the last 10 years. I think Jordan Brooks is a very talented guy who could, you know, get to the Pro Bowl and be a productive substitute. But again, what you've got with Bobby Wagner, I think with the Bobby Wagner thing, we all recognize this is business. This was a pure business decision. You've got a guy that's making $22 million a year in his contract. He's 32 years old. And, you know, unlike the quarterback position where guys can play to 40 years old, when you start getting to 32, it's kind of like that magic number for the running back when he hits 30.
Yeah.
A guy who's top two things that he needs to have is speed and durability. And that's not a winning formula for a running or for a linebacker who has, you know, more tackles than anybody else in the NFL over the last 10 years. The odds are not in his favor that he's going to be able to keep this production up for another 2 or 3 years. The drop-off was imminent. And I think the Seahawks recognizing, hey, if we're going to get rid of Russell and that contract, let's go ahead and get rid of Bobby. Maybe this isn't a total rebuild, but this is a reload and we need to take advantage of that.
Yeah, and I think I just lost.
I'm just shocked that they didn't get anything for him. That's the thing that blows.
Well, okay, me. Yeah, that's where I was going to go. So you mentioned that, but I think you hit on it, Warren, is that at his age, like when you start looking at like the great linebackers, a lot of them don't play for 10 years, you know, and then the ones that do by year 11 and 12, they're really starting to show their age. And so when you attach the salary to that, that's where you don't have any suitors. I think the situation Bobby Wagner is going to be in is kind of like the Von Miller situation, you know, where he gets, you know, released by Denver and the Rams pick him up. And now they've got a Hall of Fame defensive lineman that still has a little left in the tank, but maybe not so much left in the tank that you wanted to pay, you know, a Von Miller salary from a couple of years ago. And I think that's kind of the way forward for Bobby Wagner. Somebody's going to find him, you know, the Patriots are going to give him a 1-year contract or somebody like that is going to reach out to him and say, hey, we still think you've got something to offer. It was just, you know, not for the price that the Seahawks needed it to be at.
Right, right. Well, hey, let's turn the page on this conversation and just briefly talk about what was probably the biggest sports story at the beginning of the week. And that is the final home game of Coach Mike Krzyzewski's career with the Duke Blue Devils. It didn't go the way that the storybooks normally would write it up. They, you know, the stadium was packed. People spent weeks, or I've heard months, waiting to get tickets. It was a must-see event. The tickets were at Super Bowl level prices, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 per seat. And the Duke Blue Devils lay a total turd against their chief rival, the underperforming, underwhelming North Carolina Tar Heels. Mark, I don't know if you saw this or heard anything about this, but after the game was over and they're trying to do this tremendous celebration for Coach K, he basically like scolds the crowd for cheering for him. He's like, be quiet, be quiet. And he's like, I'm sorry, this was not acceptable, you know? And he's apologizing for the one game when people are trying to celebrate one of the greatest careers of a college coach ever. He was obviously in the moment with what had happened with his team. But aside from that, Mark, what do we take away from this tremendous career? I think he's one of the final coaching pillars in basketball to kind of step down. What are your thoughts, your memories, your perspectives about the great Coach K?
Well, a couple things. I think, first of all, he and Duke have kind of become polarizing figures, right? Where there are people that love Coach K and love Duke, and there are people that when they watch the tournament, their primary motive is to root against Duke. Like,
right.
And I talked to buddies over the weekend that they said they hate watched it. Like they were watching it.
Yeah.
Duke would lose. You know, there are people that thought it was hilarious that the game before it was a Kansas Texas game that went into overtime. So the whole pregame ceremony that they were doing where Coach K is coming out surrounded by dozens of his former players, they had to like split screen that. And then they were late cutting to the game because the game before. So like everything about the kind of the program that they were trying to create just got ruined by everything surrounding it. The game before, the fact that they laid an egg, like Coach K is upset. Like, I mean, it was just, so if you were anti Coach K, anti Duke, you loved it. Like you just loved how
it was like Meme City. I mean, it was just like every meme you can imagine was coming out from before the game all the way through after the game.
Yeah. So, you know, stepping away from that, I've kind of somebody that when I was a kid, I grew up really rooting for Duke, just basically because my grandparents gave me a Duke sweatshirt. And then as I became more of an adult, I kind of started to turn on Duke. I think it was during the finals when they played Butler, and I thought Butler was such a great story that I found myself, well, I can't really root for Duke against Butler. Butler's just too good of a story. I'm always kind of drawn to the underdog story. And so I've become less of a Duke fan over the course of my life, oddly enough. But if we're just kind of stopping and like trying to take stock of this career, I think it's in the conversation, Warren, of the most impressive coaching careers. Now, there are coaches that have won more titles.
Yeah. You
know, we're looking at the major sports. He ended up with 5. The immediate comparison goes, well, John Wooden won 10. You know, how can he beat John Wooden? Or Nick Saban's won 7, or Bill Belichick's won 6, or Phil Jackson's won 11, or whatever. But I would say this. I would say Coach K came into a sport that did not have a shot clock, that did not have a three-point line, and in which basically every player that you recruited stayed for 4 years.
Yeah.
And he navigated all of those changes. He went to his first national championship game in 1986. He won his first championship in 1991, beating an undefeated UNLV team in the semifinals and then winning the title. You know, beat the Fab Five in 1992. So has these iconic wins over kind of these marquee programs. You know, the foundation of those early title teams were four-year players. It was Christian Laettner. It was Bobby Hurley. It was Grant Hill. All of these guys, these legendary Duke players who stayed in college for 4 years. And then he wins later titles, you know, with Shane Battier, who was a great four-year player. But by the end of his career, his last title, he had 3 one-and-done freshmen leading the team. Guys that came to Duke, they played for 6 months, and then they were out the door because he recognized that the game had shifted and that he had to shift with it. And, you know, when you – I mean, the fact that he went to his first final before the three-point line existed and then coached, you know, a team that year after year produces some of the best three-point shooting, you know, Coach J.J. Redick, one of the greatest college shooters of all time. Like, he has existed in this sport during such a time of profound change that I can't think of another coach who presided over such an extended era, you know, where, like, I mean, the game didn't change that much for Phil Jackson from the time he was coaching Jordan's Bulls to Kobe's Lakers. And he, you know, he just happened to coach arguably the 3 greatest players over a 20-year stretch in coaching Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal, and Kobe Bryant. And he got 11 titles or whatever. Like, yeah, I mean, was Phil Jackson a great coach? Sure he was. But, like, Phil Jackson didn't have to navigate, like, a totally different NBA, you know, in which basically the fundamental rules of the game had changed beneath his feet while he was coaching it. I think what Coach K has done is so unique in sports that I can't really imagine somebody else starting out coaching now, like what that would what that would be like. It would be like a coach who started out like before the forward pass in the NFL, and then he was winning Super Bowls with Patrick Mahomes. Like, that's kind of the eras that he has bridged.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder if it's just because of my age and, you know, the experiences that I had in those fundamental years of my life. But, you know, to me, I think basketball, both in the NBA and college basketball, really hit its stride in the early 80s. And it, again, maybe by just my opinion, kind of hit its zenith in the early to mid 90s, both for the NBA and college basketball. And again, maybe it's just my own personal bias, but to me, because of that, at least for me, when you think about who was at the top of the ladder, at the top of the game during that rise of college basketball and the zenith of college basketball, it was Coach K. I mean, he was the ultimate basketball coach. Duke was the ultimate program. Obviously, UNC was right there at the top as well, which was so fascinating to have two teams that were so geographically close to one another and so competitive with one another, and both having iconic long-term coaches. Obviously, you know, UNC experienced that shift to Roy Williams much sooner, but the point being that for me, whether you loved him or hated him, and whether you loved or hated Duke, you couldn't ignore them because they were the ultimate team. And then to your point, to kind of, I think, navigate the decline of college basketball and the changes that have subsequently come and be able to continue to be successful and create a national championship team as recently as 2015 really is pretty remarkable. That coach, because I mean, I think, you know, this is the Dog and Duck Show, so I don't think it's out of place to bring this up, but Chris Peterson, in my opinion, he got out of college football because he saw where it was going and he said, this is not what I want to do. This is not what I want to be about. And I'm sure that there were probably moments for Coach K over the last 40 years where he thought to himself, if this is where college basketball is going, I don't want to do it anymore. But he didn't just eject and retire and fade off into the sunset. He continued to morph and change and adjust and adapt and endure through all of those changes. And I think that the lasting testimony of his career is that, you know, he was successful at every stage of the evolution of college basketball.
You think, I think about it this way, in terms of how college basketball has shifted from kind of star-driven to coach-driven in a weird way. So, like, if you go back all the way to the 1950s, before John Wooden peaked, if you look at the list of Final Four most outstanding players, you have names like Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, Jerry Lucas. These are all, you know, NBA 75 guys, right? Then you get into the John Wooden era, and he's got Lou Alcindor for 3 years and Bill Walton, who was a two-time Final Four Most Valuable Player. So he's winning a lot of his titles on the backs of these dominant, you know, generational talented players. If you get into the like late 70s, early 80s, you had a run there where it was Magic Johnson winning a title over Larry Bird, then it's Isaiah Thomas, then it's James Worthy and Michael Jordan, then it's Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler, and then it's Patrick Ewing. So again, it's like it is these Hall of Fame players who are generational talents in the college basketball game, and that pretty much gives way to the Coach K era. So Patrick Ewing won his title in 1984. Since then, Warren, I think there have been two Final Four Most Valuable Players that will end up being Hall of Famers. And I think it was Carmelo Anthony, who was a one and done player at Syracuse, and Anthony Davis, who was a one and done player at Kentucky.
Hmm.
And that's it. And if you look at like the guys that Duke won with, Grant Hill will be a Hall of Famer. He was not one of the most outstanding players of the Final Four. But the guys that Coach K has on this list, Christian Laettner, Bobby Hurley, Shane Battier, Kyle Singler, Tyus Jones, none of those names translate to NBA superstardom. So John Wooden built his legacy with Lou Alcindor and Bill Walton.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Krzyzewski built his legacy with, you know, Shane Battier and Kyle Singler and Christian Laettner. Like, it's a totally different game now. The greatest players in college basketball history over the last 25 years have, for the most part, not translated to become NBA stars. It just is not the same thing. And so that's why sometimes people will look at like the NBA roster that, say, Dean Smith has produced, which is unbelievable. Michael Jordan, James Worthy, Rasheed Wallace, Vince Carter, Jerry Stackhouse, like all of these great players. And they compare that to Coach K, and it's like, well, you got Grant Hill, and who else do you have? You have Kyrie Irving, who barely played at Duke. Like, there's not a lot there. But I think
that's not fair to say. There's a lot at Duke. This was not scraps.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, you know, Shane Battier was a good NBA player. JJ right. Redick was a good NBA player.
Right.
Not like stars, you know, not like all-star, you know, level players. Certainly not the level of Vince Carter or Michael Jordan or James Worthy. But for the most part, what Coach K has done is he's produced really, really good college basketball players. He has six yeah. different players that he's coached that won National Player of the Year. Bobby Knight, Dean Smith, and Roy Williams combined have coached five National Players of the Year. Coach K has coached four different guys to Defensive Player of the Year. Nobody else has had more than two players
yeah.
win Defensive Player of the Year. So like, he has turned out year right. after really, really, really good college basketball players. Some yeah. of them have become very good NBA players. Many of them have not. But that doesn't reflect on his legacy at all. Like, he right. is, his job was to win games at the college level. And if that was with Kyle Singler and John Shire, that's how he did it, you know?
But, you know, just to say, hey, let's be really honest here. Once the Duke train started, you know, picking up steam, Duke was a place that routinely was recruiting the best basketball players in the country year in and year out. McDonald's All-Americans, All-State players. These were not guys that, you know, nobody else was looking at, and Coach K saw something and turned them into superstars. Every single year that if there was a recruiting ranking, which they didn't do as much of that, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. But during that time, you knew Duke was getting the pick of the litter. The yeah. fact that some of those guys did not become transcendent NBA superstars shouldn't change the narrative that coming out of high school, Duke was the place for the best basketball players in the country to go to.
Yes, I think you're right there. I think the only thing I was trying to point out is that that the type of player Coach K was recruiting, he was forecasting these are going to be really great college players. Whereas mm-hmm. like somebody like John Calipari, like, he has produced much better NBA players than Coach K. He coached Derrick Rose, he coached Devin Booker, he coached John Wall and Anthony Davis and Carl Anthony Towns and DeMarcus Cousins. And like, I mean, there are a lot of like NBA all-star level guys over the last few years that have come through Calipari. Calipari only won one championship with those guys. Right. They oftentimes didn't leave Kentucky as finished products.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Coach K did seem to kind of invest his time in a different type of player. You're absolutely right. It's not like he was coaching the bottom of the barrel. He was right. Taking his pick. He was getting McDonald's All-Americans. These were guys that any other school would have loved to have.
Right.
But you would think that five NBA or five NCAA titles would lead to, you know, kind of this group of NBA superstars. And it just doesn't. Like, some of those rosters are devoid of anyone that had a memorable NBA career.
Well, and I think that is, you know, like, that is the magic of what Duke was able to accomplish. And I think why Duke was able to accomplish what they did was because he was getting the best high school players, but he was getting guys that were not thinking, I just want to get to the NBA and this is a necessary evil to get there. And so he had the pick of the litter. And as he chose the pick of the litter, he was picking those guys like Shane Battier that were saying, I want to be a Duke Blue Devil for 3-4 years, and really committed to the program. And I think, you know, Calipari, we'll save him for a totally different podcast, because he's, you know, I mean, he was a guy that basically said, I'm going to zig where everybody else zags, and I'm not going to fight this idea that, you know, college students only want to spend a year, or I mean, high school students only want to spend a year in college and then go straight to the NBA. I'm going to take advantage of that. And so he basically sold guys on that vision of come for a year and then get to the NBA. And that was not the message that, at least up until maybe recently, that Coach K was preaching, but he was still getting, like, let's say a guy that, you know, was a 99 out of 100, those guys may have been going to Kentucky or North Carolina, but he was getting the guy that was a 92 out of 100. And I think that's the secret to winning in college basketball, is getting those guys who are not looking to go to the NBA after 1 year, but at least give the program 2 years and give them a chance to build something.
Yeah, and the interesting thing for Coach K is he has shifted, and he did win a title with the one-and-done guys. It was Jahlil Okafor and Justice Winslow. But what's interesting is, so 2010, he wins the title with Kyle Singler, John Shire, and Nolan Smith, which were all four-year guys.
Yeah.
In the last 12 years, he got that one title with the one-and-done guys. He has not been to the Final Four with any of the rest of them. And it was really the next year when he recruited Kyrie Irving that he started to make that shift.
Yeah.
Which then led to, you know, some of these other guys like Zion Williamson and others.
Right.
And so he's had this the last 12 years, he's gotten the title. He also missed the tournament for the first time in forever last year.
Yeah.
And he's had some pretty staggering upset losses. They were a 2 seed and they lost to Lehigh, led by CJ McCollum. They were a 3 seed and they lost to Mercer 1 year. So it hasn't worked out, like, relative to the rest of Coach K's career, where most decades he has multiple Final Four appearances. You know, to only have one Final Four in the last 12 years is actually, in ridiculous terms, it's kind of a slump for Coach K relative to the success that he had leading up to that. So this whole kind of transition to the 1-1 has been him adjusting the time. He still won a ton of games for the most part, with that one exception of last season, but it hasn't necessarily led to the deep tournament runs that those senior laden teams were making in prior years.
Well, hey, as we kind of wrap this up, and we could spend a lot of time, you know, talking about, you know, where his status is with, you know, all-time coaching greats. You know, I mean, there's a list. You mentioned Phil Jackson, John Wooden, you know, obviously in college football, Nick Saban, you know, at the NFL, Bill Belichick, you know, we could go on and on and on. But I'm actually going to change the subject, because I think, you know, what you said just now about the fact that here you have Coach K, you have Duke, like that's like the upper echelon.
Yeah.
And they've only made one Final Four in the last 12 years. And this is the question that I want to kind of wrestle with for just a couple minutes before we wrap this thing up today. But it's this question of, why is it, in your estimation, Mark, that college basketball has so much parity in it, you know, comparatively, whereas college football is pretty much, you know, limited to four or five teams that could potentially win a national championship year in and year out? I mean, the conditions are essentially the same. You know, the players are kind of typically from the same areas, coming from the same areas. You've got the same kind of money invested in these programs. You've got the transfer portal. You've got the NIL. What is it about college basketball that's creating more parity? Or correct me if I'm wrong, if you don't think that there's parity in college basketball, correct me, but it seems to me that there's much more parity in college basketball than there is in college football. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a different sport. I think it's in college basketball, to build, you know, a national championship contender, getting one or two key players can make a huge difference. Like, that can take a team that's an average team and turn them into a Final Four caliber team. So that's one thing, is building a basketball contender just takes much less manpower than building a really good football team. Building a really good football team doesn't just require you to get 22 starters, but you have to have a lot of depth because of the amount of injuries. You know, there are 85 scholarship players on a college football team, and a lot of them get used throughout a season. A lot of these, you know, teams that are going to be playing in the tournament are going to have seven or eight guys that they're really playing big minutes and that they're really counting on in a big way. And that's just easier. You know, there are a lot more players of that caliber to kind of spread around to give each team seven or eight rather than to give each team 85. So that's one thing. It's like Alabama is just amassing, you know, multiple rosters worth of talent that's not being spread around to other teams. I think the second thing is just the nature of the postseason. You have a lot more teams involved, and it's one and done. You have to win six games in order to win a title. Now, I think if Alabama had to win six single elimination games, I still think they would steamroll everyone because of that talent that they've amassed up. But I think, you know, one of the things that we're starting to see in the women's game, where UConn was so dominant for so long, and now has had a few years where they haven't even, you know, been able to make the championship game, is we're just starting to see that there are more teams capable of getting hot on the right night and taking out UConn. Like right now, the best women's player in the country, I think, is a girl named Caitlin Clark, who's a sophomore at the University of Iowa, and she's fantastic. And if they're like a two seed in UConn's region, it wouldn't shock anybody if she had 40 points against UConn and beat them in the Elite Eight, and their season's over. And that's what's happened with some of these one and done teams that Coach K has brought in. Super talented teams. They go 32-5 or something like that, and somebody beats them in the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight, because that's the nature of the tournament, is it's so topsy-turvy that it's really hard to, you know, to win the tournament. Usually you have to get lucky at least once. You know, there's a reason they call it survive in advance. You have to have that one game where you just kind of get the lucky break that you need in order to win. And that can lead to all kinds of different combinations of random teams. that make it in. If you look back over the Final Fours of the past few years, there's teams that you forgot were even in it, where you're like, oh, that's right. That was the random year that South Carolina made the Final Four. Like, I forgot that. You know, South Carolina usually doesn't even make the tournament. But one year as a seven seed, they made it all the way to the Final Four because they just kind of caught lightning in a bottle. It's so much harder for that to happen in football. So many, you know, that's like, it would be like Iowa State having the season they had last year where they beat Oklahoma and they just kind of get hot, but then continuing that through three or four playoff games against teams the caliber of Ohio State and Clemson and something like that. That's just, you know, that's just asking a lot,
right,
of a college football team. We're in, college basketball has a structure that creates that year after year.
Yeah. You know, assuming that you don't have this pulled up and on screen in front of you, Mark, I'm wondering, can you tell me the last coach, the last team to win two NCAA championships in a row in college basketball?
Well, I think it would have been Florida in, what was that, 2006, 2007. Yeah. So that was Billy Donovan coached Florida team. Am I right?
You got it. Yeah. You do not disappoint.
And that was a team with Joakim Noah and Al Horford.
Yeah.
So those were two serious NBA talents that stuck around, came back to play for another year. And it was important to them to repeat as back-to-back champs. It's rare to find a team with talent like that that sticks around for a year after winning a title.
I mean, and, you know, great job remembering that and capturing that. And I think that, to me, is what's so fascinating about this whole discussion is basically, you know, you've got college football where it's like you pretty much assume it's going to be Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, and then some other transcendent SEC team that you know, captures the national championship. Whereas in college basketball, the last team to win two in a row was, you know, over 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I think college football, somehow the powers that be need to figure out how to create some more parity in the sport. We all love the greats, but you know, if you're a college basketball fan, if your team gets into the tournament, you're always feeling like, man, if we can get hot, we might have a chance at this thing. I mean, you look at, you know, UCLA last year, nobody really was expecting much from them. And then they get on run, they almost make it to the playoffs, if not for a miracle shot at the end of the game against Gonzaga. So I think that's what, you know, March Madness is all about. That's why we love college basketball. Yeah. But it's a fascinating thing. And so then to say, going back to Coach K, you know, okay, he's only made one Final Four in the last 12 years. Well, looking at the state of college basketball, that's not surprising.
Right.
That's the way that college basketball is structured at this point. It's not a sport that has, over the last 15 years, demonstrated, you know, a lot of dominance by certain programs.
Yeah, and if you look at his seeding in that time, he's had a one or a two seed, you know, six or seven times during that stretch. And right. So consistently top four, top eight teams in the country, but that's still hard to necessarily translate that to deep tournament runs every single year.
Yeah. Well, hey, it's been a great, great show. Thank you, Mark, and good stuff as always. So if you're listening to the Dog and Duck Show, thank you. Please be sure to subscribe, like, and we've got a March Madness special that we'll be putting out probably early next week. So stay tuned for that. But with that, we'll wrap it up. For all my dog fans out there, go Dogs.
And for all my Duck fans, go Ducks.
We'll catch you next time.